This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to another episode of the Aftershock Central Podcast. Explosions, explosions. Isn't that what happens when you have earthquakes? Stuff explodes?
Yeah. See? Especially by propane tanks and whatnot.
Oh, I don't know anything about that.
Haven't you seen Twister?
Yeah, in like 95.
Well, Martin, propane is very highly flammable.
That's what I hear. That is what I hear. My wife and daughter actually watch that every year. Like, at least once a year. They love,
really?
They love rewatching stuff, and they love Twister.
Well, it's for the cow scene, right?
I guess. Reagan's got this thing about, Reagan's my oldest daughter. She's got a thing about disaster movies. So whenever a new one comes out, we have to go watch it, no matter what it is.
Oh.
Yeah. We haven't seen Geostorm yet, but I think she bought it. So we'll watch it at some point.
I was working at the theater when the disaster movies were a thing.
Yeah.
So you had like Deep Impact and Armageddon and Deep Blue Sea even.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Come on, man. Armageddon was the jam. You don't want to miss a thing.
Here we go. Now, who has hashtag dad jokes?
Dad jokes all around. So if you've noticed, Travis is not joining us today. That's because Ronnie and I are overachievers, and we're recording during a lunch break. And Travis is slaving away at his job, so he couldn't join. It was just us. And really, that's okay, because there's not much news. There's only one book to talk about. But I did want to bring something up that Travis brought up in our chat. I think it was last night, right? I think it was.
Yeah, I think it was.
So I think Travis gets a lot of these books digitally, which makes sense. I do as well. Are you getting print copies or digital copies?
I started out getting print copies, but I've been weeding back and getting mostly stuff digital.
Yeah, yeah.
But I will get, like, trades and hardcovers and whatnot.
Yep. So, I mean, Aftershock is kind enough to send us preview copies. Insert joke here, Ronnie. No? Most weeks.
No. Most weeks.
Yeah. But either way, like, I usually don't read the review copies. Matter of fact, I don't read any review copies that any publisher sends me. Unless it's, like, way ahead of time, right? So I read, what's the book?
That Zach Savage?
No, the book that Zach and Lonnie are doing. Come Into Me. I did read that, even though that's not out till like, April or something. And I don't think I can talk about it yet, because I think NDA'd till, like, the last week of March on talking about that book. Anyways, so usually I don't read ahead of time, but I did read that one. Because I like to buy the books. I like, obviously, we love Aftershock, and I like to support Aftershock, so I buy the books. But yeah, I'm the same way. I used to get them print, but it's just so much easier just to get digital copies.
So right.
That's what I've been doing. Except for whenever I go to a con or something, I might buy like a con exclusive from Aftershock, or usually I'll buy the trades directly from the Aftershock booth.
Yeah. Oh, Black Eyed Kids, I got floppies of all of Black Eyed Kids.
I think I did also accept the last issue.
Well, now you know what you gotta search for now.
Yeah. Matter of fact, isn't there a C2E2 exclusive? Yes, there is. There's a C2E2 exclusive Shock at the booth, isn't there?
I think so.
I thought I saw that last night. So I've got to pick that up. Anyways, I'm glad we're talking about Shock, because this is something that Travis brought up in our chat about the pricing of the digital copy. And I wanted to talk to you about it real quick and see what you thought. Because I want to say the book is like 35 or 40 bucks, right?
Yes, 35.
35. And the digital copy is the same price. How do you feel about that?
For me, for small publishers, it doesn't bother me as much, really. Now, if like Marvel or DC or Image was doing it, then I'd have more of an issue with it. Mm. But I mean, I get it. I get what you and Travis were saying about, because it's digital, it should be cheaper. But to me, I don't know. I see it as a small publisher trying to get what they can from everything, from all angles.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it was the same as a floppy, because like Travis, for example, he's all digital. So, you know, you're not going to get the $35 for the hardcover.
Sure.
So, you know, maybe $5 cheaper. I don't know. But unless it's been out for, you know, 3 or 4 months and then drop it down. But also, like, for example, Aftershock hasn't had that many Comixology sales either, though.
Yeah, that's what bugs our buddy Nick, right? Because Nick loves Aftershock, but he'll only buy the books when they go on sale.
Did you just call him Lick? Nick
the Lick. Nick the Lick.
He's Mr. Mitsopolik's cousin, then.
Mr. Nickel Lick. Episode title.
There you go.
And that was kind of my point to him was, I understand why they do it, because I think it's especially important for a small publisher to not have a big disparity in pricing between physical and digital copies, because I would say even still now, with the growth of digital, comic shops are especially important for small indie publishers.
Yeah.
And, you know, if they were putting out this book at $35 and then they put it on Comixology for, like, 15 or 20, then no shop's going to order it, because they're going to be like, well, nobody's going to buy it. They can get it, you know, half price, a third price on Comixology.
Correct.
And I think that's generally been the case throughout, right? So, like, Comixology will start discounting after a few weeks for some books. They'll drop, like, $1.
Yeah.
Or then, like, they'll do the once a year, twice a year sales for 99 cents or, you know, $1.99. Because by that point, it doesn't really matter to the shop as much, right? By that point, right. The shop hopes that they will have sold of their whatever they ordered. And at that point, it becomes a back issue game anyway.
Yeah. And I think it's like a business model, too, like of the publisher. Because, like, for Aftershock, for example, they're hard or physical copy. And they like to go out and talk to different shops or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like, on the other hand, you have Action Lab, who is more digital focused.
Yeah.
And has very little floppies.
Well, and I know that I'm not sure what the sales numbers digitally are for Aftershock. I believe they're still pretty low compared to the physical copies.
Right.
But I do know of at least one publisher that it's almost like 50%.
Yeah.
And this is not Action Lab. This is actually a fairly well-known, I don't want to say big, it's still an indie publisher, but it's much bigger.
Yeah, I think I know which one you're talking
about. Yeah, I'm not going to say which one it is, because I don't want to out them.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like almost 50%, like 40-50%. So, I mean, it's interesting. I understand Travis's point. To me, a digital file is worthless. Not worthless, but worth space less.
Yeah,
because it's infinitely reproducible, right? Like, you make one copy, and then it doesn't cost you anything to make another copy.
Right.
But I get that publishers are in a tough spot when it comes to juggling physical and digital copies. So I don't blame them for it being $35. Because of the price being the same, I ordered a physical copy of the book. I'm not going to do a digital on that one.
Right. I might double dip, actually.
Will you?
Yeah.
Well,
because, I mean, for me, when I read, it's mostly at night while I'm laying in bed trying to wind down. I don't want to have the light on. And my wife yells and screams at me because she can't sleep because the light's on.
Sure.
So.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, I think we're going to be double dipping anyway, right? Because if I ordered a copy and now they announced this C2E2 exclusive,
yeah,
we're going to have to get that one.
Yeah. Just like I double-dipped on the Animosity Volume 1 trade.
Yep. Oh, that's right. We got that last year.
Yeah, because I already had Volume 1 of the regular cover, and then you and I bought the last two blank variant covers of it.
I don't think... dang, I need to take that with me. I didn't get anything on it.
Yeah.
Mine's still blank. Matter of fact, I think it's still in my C2E2 bag.
I have plans for it. I'm waiting for the artist to mail me back, though.
Oh. Is it that one guy?
One guy that only publishes it in black and white?
Yeah, buddy.
Yeah,
okay. Nice. So, I guess we should say, I don't know if we said it on this podcast, but Ronnie and I will be at C2E2 this year again.
Woo-hoo!
So, if you're going to be at C2E2, then come find us. We'll probably be all over the place. I know Ronnie and I were talking about setting up a bunch of interviews with folks outside of Aftershock. We can't talk about it. It's a secret. But we'll be around.
We'll be easily obtainable.
Yeah, we'll be easily obtainable with our cease and desist shirts.
That's right.
All right, let's go ahead and get over these shenanigans. Let's talk about a book. We only had one book this week, Monstro Mechanica, number 4. And this is co-created and written by Paul Aller, co-created and art by Chris Evenhaas. The colors are Sean Weirs and letters by Paul Aller. So our intern, Travis, is not here to do a nutshell recap. So how about we skip that? Let's just talk about the book. Is that cool with you?
Yeah, I'm good with that.
All right. So we get some, there's some interesting stuff in this book that I think they've been like playing off in the background a little bit throughout the whole series, but it's starting to develop now, and that's the political aspect of this book.
Yeah.
I think the last time, when we talked about issue 3, I was wondering if Da Vinci is not kind of the villain of this series.
Yeah.
And with the events of this issue, I wonder if I wasn't right. And I could still be wrong. You know, the siege is over. Monstro Mechanica has been, quote-unquote, defeated. I mean, I guess he was, right? He's busted to pieces.
Right, yeah.
And so Medici, who we assume has been the villain the whole time, comes into the town to try to win the hearts of the people, right? So the plot of the siege was his idea all along, and the way that he's going to take over this town is to be like, hey, I'm here to give you guys reparations because you guys lost everything, but I'm the good guy. Here's some money.
Right.
Freaking take it.
Yeah, while he's screaming at him. Yeah.
Yeah. That was my favorite part, by the way. When he goes to that lady and she's tending to that injured man, and he's like, oh, you know, here's some gold coins for the funeral and whatever the hell else. She's like, no, I can't take that. He's like, take the money. It was the best. It was the best. I don't remember a whole lot about Medici history, but this seems to fit pretty well from what I remember in history class about the Medicis.
Yeah.
They were a wealthy merchant family that ruled pretty much all of Italy at the time. And there was a lot of back and forth between the church and the Medicis. I believe the Pope at one time was a Medici. It's all pretty interesting. I like the little alternate history thing that we have here with the Monstro and Da Vinci.
Yep.
Because it does seem to make sense based on what we know, right?
Right.
How'd you feel about this issue?
Well, I didn't get the feel that Da Vinci was starting to be the villain of the book like you thought, so we'll have to dive into that.
Okay.
To me, it just seems like he's so smart he doesn't care how he comes off. So he's gonna play both sides.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter who he crushes on. It's just, you know, he's all about himself. And here's my great new invention. Let's sell it to the highest bidder type thing. And what way to get the highest bidder is have them or assess them both. And then whoever wins, you know, gets the machine.
Sure. Yeah, I don't know. I couldn't tell because there was something towards the end when Da Vinci and Medici are sitting down at the table and they're like going back and forth about the future of the city. I almost got the sense that, like, you know what? You might be right. Maybe Da Vinci is not the villain, because maybe he is the one that's actually trying to take down the Medici's.
Well, I think ultimately it'll be Isabella that is our hero of the book.
Sure.
I just think that he's an instrument, basically. He's not really good or bad. Like I said, he's just a prick out for himself.
Yeah, but see, now that we say that, and that's why maybe I thought he was the villain, but with that thing at the end, right? So he offers pretty much like an army of monstros to Medici, right? To safeguard this city, and I'm assuming whatever other places that Medici is ruling over. He's like, you know, my one monstro took down like an army of dudes. Imagine if you had like an army of monstros.
Right.
Right. You'd be unstoppable. They could just patrol the city. Nobody would ever be able to do anything.
Right. But that's what I'm saying is like he's selling himself. It's not to make the city better. It's just basically he's like the used car salesman.
But he does have control over the monstros, right? And he knows what Isabella has been doing with the one monstro.
Right, yeah.
So by offering up these services, don't you think that maybe he sees a potential way out? Right? Like he's been working with these guys because they pay him. Right? Yeah. That's how he makes his livelihood. But what if he knows that, I mean, obviously he knows that this Medici is not a good guy.
Right, yeah.
Right? And by offering this army of monstros, he can get Medici to fund this project, and then he can use his secret knowledge and Isabella to kind of take over Medici's empire.
Yeah, I can see that now, yeah.
And you know, and that could go either way, right? Because he could be taking it over for himself, or take it over to free everybody that's under Medici rule.
Right. Yep, good point. Now that you say it like that, it makes sense.
Yeah. What about the stuff at the... I'm assuming... It's not the Vatican, right? Because that's not the Pope.
Right.
The stuff with the Cardinal. Because that hasn't been really explained either, right? We know the Cardinal and the Medicis are against each other. But we see what's the character that got freed from the tower?
I'm looking here.
I can't remember his name.
Ria Rio?
Sure.
Senor Ria Rio?
There you go.
I think.
That guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Who accidentally on purpose stabs him? I mean, come on. You know, you can tell two different daggers.
You think so?
Yeah, because he's a smug, arrogant guy, so I'm assuming that he did it on purpose.
Yeah, I think he did as well. That scene was pretty funny, though, right? Because he comes from behind the Cardinal, stabs him with what he thinks is a wooden dagger. He's like, oh, you're fine, it's a wooden dagger. And he's like, oops, maybe not.
Yeah.
But I still think that he and Da Vinci are working together.
Interesting.
You don't think so?
Well, I mean, they have to be at some capacity if Da Vinci sent Isabella up there to rescue him.
It seems to me like it would make sense, because if Da Vinci is trying to take down the Medicis, then by default, there wouldn't be a power struggle, right? The cardinal in the church would automatically take over and fill in that seat of power.
Right.
And I think Da Vinci is smart enough to be able to plan, you know, 30 steps ahead. And he doesn't want the church to take over power either. So it would make perfect sense to pit these two powers against each other and then use whatever extra money or power he was given to get involved in this war to go against both of these powers, right? Because remember, you had Machiavelli in here, right?
Yeah.
And what better way to take over your enemy than to have them fight from within?
Right.
Right? Like, then he doesn't have to do anything, right? They kill each other, and then by default, here you are. You're the one in power now.
Yep. So do you think that Da Vinci's using Riario also, like a chess piece, like a pawn type thing?
Yeah.
And Riario doesn't know?
I think Riario knows to some extent, but I think because he's such a pompous ass, he maybe doesn't see the full extent of the plan.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, but he's definitely a pawn in the game. You know, he could have been like, hey, if you help me do this, I'll let you, like, rule this town. Yeah. And he's like, all right, I'm down.
Yeah.
You know?
He doesn't see the forest for the trees.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. There you go. So, yeah, I thought it was an interesting issue. It read a lot quicker than the rest of them, I think.
Because yeah, I did.
There were quite a few panels that were no dialogue. It was just fighting. So it went a lot quicker than normal. But I think overall it was a good issue. And I'm still digging the art, man. The Evan Haas has a very different art style than a lot of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're not... I mean, you might read more than I do because you're reading all that Titan stuff. But I don't read a whole lot of European comics. And I wonder if that's just not a like a typical style for European artists.
Mm-hmm.
Or if the art styles aren't more varied in European comics than in American comics. Because I think in the U.S. we're used to, like, a certain look and feel.
Right.
Yep. And that's probably been true, I mean, I don't know, late 80s, since the late 80s?
Yeah, I was going to say, yep.
And then
mid-90s, I would say.
Yeah, mid-90s. And even before that, right, like, everybody, there was a house style at Marvel and DC. And in some respects, there still is, but they allow for a more varied look and feel for the books. But even then, I don't think it's as varied as European comics are. And I really dig it. I really dig it. It's extremely clean. It's really clean.
Yeah. And one thing that helps it out, too, is the subtle switch in colors of the vibrant colors. Like when we're in Florence with Riario and the Cardinal, it's kind of maroon purplish is, and then back when we're in Volterra with Da Vinci, it's like greens and they're vibrant and they pop out.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. So you want to rate this one up?
Yeah. I'm gonna give it a 4.5 out of 5. See you next time. Taco Tamos.
Well, I'm going to give this a 4 out of 5. I just had nacho fries for the first time, and they were delicious.
I'm so jealous.
They were really good. They come with this little nacho cheese dipping sauce.
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. And they have, like, the little, like, Doritos sauce, or not sauce, but breading. Kind of on them.
Yeah, they have crushed up Doritos. See, so So Paul Aller is like the fries, and then Evan Haas is like the Dorito seasoning, and then Sean Weirs is like the nacho dipping sauce.
That's right.
Mm. Nacho fries. Get some. All right, cool. Anything else we need to discuss, or should we wrap this up?
Let's wrap it up.
You have been listening to the Aftershock Central Podcast. Woo! You can find Ronnie on Twitter at Rumbar316. Travis is at The Great Magnet. I am at Geekvine. The show is at Aftershock Pod. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Shock the world. I had to throw that in there for Travis.